I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is food journalist, author, and former columnist for the New York Times, Mark Bittman. He's joined in conversation by Sunset Magazine's Margot True. And now, join Barbara Lane on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Mark Bittman and Margot True.
Former New York Times columnist Mark Bittman, known for his straightforward, accessible style, is the author of more than a dozen cookbooks. He's here tonight with his latest, How to Bake Everything, the ultimate baking resource for any cook. Joining him in conversation is Sunset Magazine food editor Margot True. Please welcome them both to the JCCSF.
Well,
thank you all for coming. And we'll just dive right in, shall we?
Yeah.
You know, after How to Cook Everything, which many of us, myself included, feel is one of the most important cookbooks of the last 20 years, sold over a million copies, you've written cookbooks about vegetarianism, flexitarianism, Vegan Before Six, which was also groundbreaking, fish, cooking fast. Why is it baking this time?
Well, I ran out of other stuff.
No, there's meat. There's always meat.
Everybody thinks of baking as a separate category. Really, it's a subset of... Really, obviously, it's a subset of cooking. But it is worth considering by itself. And while there were a lot of recipes for baked goods and how to cook everything, it seemed a category worth tackling by itself. And it was something, you know, when I did How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, I used to say it wasn't to get in touch with my inner vegetarian, because there is no inner vegetarian. It was to become more expert in the world of plants. So this, in a way, is a personal project, a way to become more expert in the world of baking. And it turned out well. So whether it was a good idea or not, I'm happy with the result.
Well, I'll say it turned out well. It's 2,000 recipes, goes all around the globe. I mean, from simple white bread coffee cake to Afghan snowshoe naan.
You're the second person to point that recipe
awesome.
Out
I was
today.
So excited when I saw that. Chinese bao, you know, really useful. So you've sort of got the introductory end, the familiar end, but you also have some really tricky recipes too that would be considered tricky by most home cooks, like phyllo. Croque en bouche, which you say, you know, if cream puffs had ambitions, this is what they'd want to be when they grew up.
Right. I mean, I don't think there's anything that challenging in there. Some stuff is time consuming or maybe a bit labor intensive, but you know, we didn't get into fancy stuff, and it's not decorative at all, or hardly. Mm-hmm. My favorite easy/complicated recipe, or easy/time-consuming recipe in there is croissant, because if you make croissant for people, you blow their minds, and that's always nice. Yeah. Croque en bouche does that also, but croissants, because the bar for croissants now is set so low. Mm. And you're going to exceed it by so much, it's mind-blowing. It's really mind-blowing.
Yeah, because, you know, I was really impressed by your approach to sourdough bread with the starter you make yourself, because, as we all know, there are baking books out there, famous baking books, where the sourdough portion, or the introductory bread portion, can be a whole chapter. And yours is a page, with a sidebar that adds another page. But you know, how do you break down these incredibly, what most of the world thinks of as an incredibly complicated process, I mean, are you, how, what was
it's
your
not a conscious, sourdough? I can, here's how I learned how to cook. I learned how to cook fairly, when I was quite young, fairly leisurely, mostly for myself. Mm-hmm. I took my time. But then by the time I was in my mid-late 20s, I was cooking for a wife and a kid and sometimes friends. And I was always behind, just like every other cook is. I was always behind. So I'd look at a recipe and I'd think, you know, I don't have to do this part. I really could skip that part. I could shortcut this part. And that's how my style developed. And I think now, you know, I would not put anything in a cookbook that I myself wouldn't at least consider making. And most of them are things that I've made several times and things that I consider worth doing in terms of the sort of cost-work-benefit relationship. It's if there's a personality to my books, it's that, you know, I think, as you pointed out at the beginning, I've chosen interesting subjects for the most part, and that's about curiosity. But I think, you know, if there's a style, the style is show the big picture, show that all cookies are essentially the same, show that all soups are the same, show that all breads have something in common, and then show the individuation among them, but don't ever make it seem like it's a big deal. And I don't, it's, I'm not, it is work. Mm-hmm. It is work, but it's not a system. I don't say, oh, well, now we do this part, now we do this part. It just becomes clear as mm-hmm. I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I used to claim that, you know, that I wasn't creative and that it wasn't a creative process, but in fact, I realized that it is. I mean, it's no two cookbooks are the same. Mine have a style that's emerged over the years. I'm happy about it. But I can't explain it any more than I can explain. You know, I taught journalism at Berkeley last semester, and I realized I had no idea how to teach journalism. So that was okay. It was a learning experience for everyone. But I couldn't teach cookbook writing either. It's just something I do. I only can teach by example, I think. I can't, you can hear that I'm, let's move on. Don't ask me to explain anything. I'm very good at telling stories.
Well, you know, this book is very much, all of you who are fans of How to Cook Everything, this is very much in that style.
It's,
you know,
in
it
the
is
family.
Just crammed with variations and ways to customize to every cook's taste, every cook's equipment. You know, if you don't have this pan, use that pan, you know. Substitutions on everything, a whole section on baking with special diets that includes gluten-free and vegan.
Right, against my wishes, but yeah.
You probably had to. And as usual, terrific sidebars on things like, you know, how to vary basic pound cake 7 ways or 10 things to stir into brownies and blondies. And I mean, there's so many great sidebars in this book. And it made me wonder, was it more challenging to customize baking than for savory dishes, for example? Was that a little trickier because of the chemistry involved? And I know.
I'm going to answer that question, then I'm going to tell a story about the history of this book series because I think it's germane. Mm. No, it wasn't. I think what I learned in the course of this book and what I want to express, what I have expressed in the last couple of weeks on book tour and what I want to express tonight is that baking is a subset of cooking. And this ridiculous notion that baking is science while cooking is art is a ridiculous notion. If you can cook or you can bake, if you can bake, you can cook. I know people say, oh, well, I'm a baker, I don't cook, and people say, I'm a cook and I don't bake, but it doesn't make any sense. 25% of that book is savory dishes. So I suppose you can say to me, I don't like to cook savory dishes, I really only want to make elaborate cakes. I buy that. That's fine. But if you can make elaborate cakes, there's nothing you can't cook. Yeah. And if someone says to me, I don't really care about desserts, I only want to make soups and stews or broil things or whatever, fine. But that doesn't mean you can't make desserts. I mean, it's all about mixing together some ingredients and applying heat. All cooking is. Baking is. But I mean, really. So here's the story. The sidebar thing, I was thinking about this today. So in the, I'll go pretty far back. In the late 80s, I became editor of Cook's Magazine, which was the predecessor of Cook's Illustrated. And then Cook's Magazine went out of business. A hilarious story, which I will tell sometime. But and then Chris and I went our separate ways for a year or two. I was working on The Proposal for Fish, which was my first cookbook. And then Chris called me one day out of the blue and said, I have this amazing idea, a magazine, no ads, illustrations only, black and white. Like, uh-huh. But he's one of the smartest people I've ever known, and I've never really had a boss except for him. I've never really worked for anybody except when I worked for Chris. And I liked working for Chris because he describes me as his evil twin. So clearly we have some things in common. So I went to work for Cook's Illustrated, for Chris, and we formed Cook's Illustrated with a core of people from the old Cook's, some of whom you know, some of whom went on to work at Gourmet, actually. In the middle of all this, Fish came out, and Fish, you're not supposed to write Fish cookbooks. No, they don't sell. The publishers don't even want to think about it. So I wrote this Fish cookbook because it was my passion, and it sold pretty well, and it won Beard and IACP awards, so I was kind of a golden boy. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I'm trying to not make this the longest story in the world, but, you know... If you get bored, start yelling or something. So at that point, my publisher merged with another publisher. There were a lot of machinations going on in publishing. And for a hot minute, my publisher owned Joy of Cooking. And then it split. There was a division again. And my publisher, had been a computer book publishing guy. So he was used to big, fat books like How to Use MS-DOS, you know, those kinds of things.
So the, okay.
remember that? So now you get a piece of hardware with no instructions on it at all. You're just supposed to know. So the guy said to my editor, what was that big cookbook we had for a while, that Joy something that everybody thought was so important? And she said, that was Joy of Cooking. It's the most important cookbook in the world. And he said to her, we should do something like that. Mm-hmm. And she called me and said, do you want to write the new Joy of Cooking? And I said, yeah. Why? Sure. And she said, do you want to do it the way Joy of Cooking is being done? Because this was 1994 or so, and Joy of Cooking was being redone, a major, which has since been kind of rescinded, but a major... recreation done in sort of collegial encyclopedic style, that is, a different person wrote every chapter under the supervision of the editor. You remember this,
I'm
sure.
I do.
So I said, no, I don't want to do that. I think the beauty of Joy of Cooking is that it was a person's journey through cooking, and she knew how to cook a lot, and that's what the book was about, and that's what I will do. I know how to cook a lot. I'd been cooking for 15 years at that point. Pretty much daily. I had been a food journalist and an pretty experienced and respected food writer for 12 or 15 years at that point. Mm-hmm. I was on the verge of getting a column in the Times. I had signed to do a cookbook with Jean-Georges Van Gerichten, who in those days was the most famous chef in the United States. So I thought, you know, why, if not me, who? I mean...
It's logical.
Right. The hell. So I buried myself in this very nice room in my house for 2 or 3 years and would get up at 5 a.m. and furiously write recipes. And I had a system for choosing recipes and lots of flow charts and stuff all over the walls. And I would cook a little bit at breakfast and more at lunch and even more at dinner. And this went on for quite a while. And I went through 2 or 3 editors. And finally, the day came, and the final editor, as I said, it was a tumultuous time in publishing. The final editor came and She's a friend, so I vetted this story with her. Mm-hmm. She called me and said, "What do I need to know?" And I said, "Well, what you need to know is, one, we need another year." A reasonable request in those days. Now you can't get away with it. And two, I don't know what we have here. We have 3,000 pages. We have 1,500 or 2,000 recipes. I don't know what it is. It's a book, but I don't know what it's like. I'm too deep. I can't see it. So we looked at it together, and she agreed that we needed a year, and we decided what we had was indeed something close to The New Joy of Cooking. But there were 100 or 150 recipes that didn't work. They just didn't belong. Sadly, I've lost them, or I could be publishing How to Cook Everything, The Lost Recipes, which would be really cool. But they're actually lost. But they were like wild boar and foie gras and caviar, all this sort of fancy 80s, 90s food that I really personally had no interest in, but I thought, you know, Joy of Cooking had recipes for squirrel and shark and whale.
Oh, yeah, muskrat.
Yeah, so like I thought, well, we have to have everything. We took that stuff out, and we put in popcorn, grilled cheese, hamburgers, tuna salad, that kind of stuff. And do you know, I'll get back to this, but do you know, the second or third day I was on book tour, I went to this radio station in Cincinnati. I'll never forget this. And the guy said, "You taught me how to make grilled cheese. I will never be able to thank you enough." And it was sort of then that I knew that I had done something really smart, despite... But to get to the point, during those 6 months, we said, because I had worked so much in magazines, we said, well, what if we do this magazine kind of thing of making lists of things you can add to recipes, doing lots of variations that show how simple recipes can lead to many different kinds of things. So in the original How to Cook Everything, I wouldn't do it this way now, but in the original How to Cook Everything, I believe there's a chicken breast recipe with 19 variations, 19 written variations, which is a little hard to follow, I now grant you, but there was no reason to rewrite that recipe. It was broiled chicken breast. You don't need to know anything else except what can you do with it. So anyway, we came up with these lists and these sidebars and these variations and stuff, and it really worked, and it really set the... I think that's the one of the distinguishing characteristics of How to Cook Everything, every book in the series. And to finally answer your question, we've carried that over to here.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating.
Was that fascinating?
I thought it was fascinating.
Because I could tell much shorter stories.
Well, but the thing that's so great about the sidebars is that they're not only for variations, they're also for things that I've not seen anywhere else. Things for, like, in this book, there's a sidebar called What to Do with Botched or Stale Cookies and Bars.
That's really useful stuff. Yeah.
Really useful. Yeah. And then, on the other hand, kind of the other end of the cooking expertise or the baking expertise spectrum, possibly, is 9 different ways to use sourdough starter. And that's straight from the fridge. And having made sourdough starter, you are awash in sourdough starter.
Yeah,
you don't know what to do with it. You feel bad throwing it out, bad giving it to your neighbors who are going to probably kill it. You know, and it's so great that you can do something with it.
I killed mine.
Oh, sorry.
No, I killed it on purpose.
Oh, okay.
I felt like I was enslaved by it. Yeah. I felt like it was running my life.
Yes, yes. Too much starter.
So I just felt starter. Like, you know, a yeast, there's a reason they invented powdered yeast, you know?
Yeah, you just...
I mean, I know this is heresy in San Francisco, but people are hating
sourdough killer.
Relax. It's just bread.
Well, and then there's the appendix, which is...
The appendixes are good,
the
yeah.
The appendix is so incredible. I just have to say... There's all kinds of
stuff
in this.
So glad you took notes, because I don't remember anything.
Oh,
so.
It's a great appendix. And it almost reads as though you're on the internet, actually, looking at it, because the titles are very grabby in the way that you get grabbed when you're cruising around digitally. It's like 139 recipes with 6 ingredients or fewer. Best last-minute recipes. 65 recipes to make with kids. Then there's this, like, you know, favorite recipes by flavor, which is so great because you always think, I want a chocolate dessert. I want a vanilla dessert. He has lists of both those. I want a citrus dessert. I want a caramel dessert. They're all there. You just turn right to it, and then immediately you have a host of options.
You're listening to food journalist and author Mark Bittman, whose most recent book is How to Bake Everything. He's joined in conversation by Margot True on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So it's like you anticipated every single craving that a baker could have. And so I guess this leads up to my question, which is, did you leave anything out of How to Bake Everything? It feels like you have left nothing out. You even have the Afghan bread.
Well,
the Afghan bread, but there's one thing, isn't there?
There's tons of stuff. First of all, there's something left out that I haven't discovered yet that will make me unhappy. I don't know what it is, but in the original How to Cook Everything, it was chicken pot pie, and when it was called to my attention, I was depressed.
Oh.
I mean, I didn't take antidepressants, but it was serious. I was really bummed out. We fixed that. So there's something missing, but there's nothing glaring missing that I can see. So, you know, these books are, they're all different, but they all have something in common. And what that is that they're organizational challenges. The writing, modesty aside, I'm as good a recipe writer as there's ever been. So the writing is, and I'm a good writer too, so the writing is clean. I'm not worried about it. And it gets worked to death anyway. I mean, it's not just me. You know, it gets read and edited and reread and re-edited. And, you know, I look at it the last time and then a proofreader looks at it, that stuff. But in the early days, before you have any of that, you have to say, okay, we want a chocolate chunk or chocolate chip cookie, and we want a chocolate chip cookie. Do we want an oatmeal chocolate chip cookie? Okay, do we want a oatmeal caramel chocolate chip? I mean, where do you stop? And every one of these decisions, you know, every time you say yes to something, you have to say no to many other things. Because, you know, you could write a baking book that had 10,000 recipes in it if you wanted to. Not easily, it's just time, but but you have to make choices, and I've learned that, and I've learned that, you know, this goes back to the story I was telling before about leaving those 125, 150 recipes on the cutting room floor. Better to cut the recipes before you write them, before you test them, before you edit them, rewrite them, copy edit them, proofread them, and then someone says, book is 20 pages too long, time to cut 40 recipes. Better at the beginning to say, maybe oatmeal, chocolate chip, caramel, raisin, we don't need to go that far.
Have the map of all the titles
and
of the recipes.
And it is. We make a map of, we start, but you might think that one sits down and starts writing a cookbook, but it's not like that at all. We start, what are the chapters? Might seem obvious, but, you know, you have to say what the chapters are. What are the categories within each chapter? What are the recipes within each category? It's not immutable. It doesn't mean it can't be changed later on. But if you do that work, and we call them making chapter maps, if you do that work, you have an outline of the book. And again, it doesn't mean you have to stick to it slavishly, but the chances of you saying, we have 30 cookie recipes, we can go to 29 or 31, but we know we're not going as low as 20 or as high as 40, you kind of have a sense of where the book is and what it looks like. You have a skeleton, you have a framework long before you flesh it out. And that's something I didn't do with the first How to Cook Everything. And I've since learned.
Yeah. Well, then to kind of get a little bit specific about baking, you know, it relies on this handful of ingredients, essentially. And so I'd like to ask you if you have any favorites here, especially if there are local favorites to the Bay Area that people could use, like a local flour that you know from having lived here. Butter, is there any particularly good producer of butter, sugar, eggs, and yeast?
Sugar is probably the ingredient that varies least of any ingredients ever. It would be silly to say that I did, because I've had amazing butter that I could never get again. Mm. Flour, I think, is getting better and better, but for the most part, I still use supermarket all-purpose flour for most stuff. Yeast, I use instant yeast.
Why instant?
Whole grain, well, it's just so easy. You throw it
versus
in.
Versus the active dry, which you need to proof. Yeah.
Although you don't really anymore. I mean, they've changed it so that it works. You can just mix it in with the dry ingredients. I think the thing that I've learned most about baking-wise in the last couple of years is what you might call alternative flours and whole grain flours. And there, you know, we are seeing an explosion, especially here, the Northwest, but off the coast, a little bit inland, sort of the equivalent of the Central Valley in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. And in upstate New York and New England, we are seeing farmers who are really devoting energy to grains. And we're seeing new, by which I mean old strains of wheat coming back, barley, the relatives of wheat, kamut and spelt. We're seeing really, really high quality stuff, not just organic, but very, very carefully done grains. And it's a wonderful thing.
Of fresh milled flour.
Yeah, a lot of fresh milled stuff. Yeah. And, you know, there's also, when you get into it, and I've just explored this world a little bit, but, you know, you can buy a grain attachment for your KitchenAid, or you can buy a hand cranked mill or a small electric mill in your kitchen and start grinding your own, making your own flour. And it's an amazing, it's really, you know, it's a fresh ingredient. It's really something.
Oh. Well, for the next couple of questions, I'd like to dive into go out toward the larger world of food, because as I'm sure most of you guys know, for decades, you've been writing about the larger issues around food, especially in your New York Times op-ed column. And I'd like to ask you just about a few topics in particular. One of them being meat and how beneficial it would be to our health and the health of the planet to eat less of it. And VB6 grew out of that book. And I'm curious about your opinions as to grass-fed beef and whether you consider that the same sort of issue, or does that fit in with a diet for a healthier person and healthier planet?
I'm pausing because there are no simple answers to these questions. So I wouldn't do this to you, but I could say you have to define grass-fed beef before I give you an answer to that.
Because a lot of it is grain-finished, isn't it?
It's not only that, a lot of it is grain-finished, but I can say to you, legally, this is a grass-fed animal. That animal can be kept in confinement, and the grass can be dried and processed, and it's still a grass-fed animal. So what you mean, and I...
Right. I guess what you mean is
pasture raised.
I do mean pasture raised.
That's right.
Thank you.
That is what you mean. So let's suppose that Lancet, the most respected medical journal in the world, recommends that we eat 90% less meat than we do, which it does. Let's suppose that the World Health Organization and the FAO recommend that we eat far less meat than we do. Let's suppose that, I don't know why I'm saying let's suppose, this isn't rhetorical, sorry. It's also true that if the rest of the world ate as much meat as the United States and mostly English-speaking countries around the world do, our overshoot, that is the amount of resources we use that can be replenished by the earth in a year, our overshoot would be a factor of 4. That means we'd need 4 Earths, basically, to replenish our one if everybody ate as much meat as we do. So it's clear we're going to be eating less meat. Pasture-raised beef, especially, and pasture-raised chickens and pork, but pasture-raised beef especially, is something that can be worked into a solid, smart agricultural environment in a way that feedlot beef can't be. And it's also, by the way, it's also more expensive to raise. But in a way, that's okay. Because what you're saying is we need better beef, We need beef that's better for the environment. We need beef that's better for the cows. We need beef that's actually better for us. It costs more to do it that way, but at least we're acknowledging what those costs are. And since we're eating less of it, our budget mm-hmm. could actually go down. So long run, I think that's what's going to happen. Short run, you have a factory farming system that is profitable, that works, and it's not profitable necessarily for the farmers, but it's profitable for the marketers. And there's a lot of pressure to continue it. And it's a system in which one part feeds, no pun intended, on another. We are raising, 30 or 40% of the corn and soy we raise goes into animal feed. You look at the Midwest, all you see is corn and soy. To make this kind of transition is not going to be an easy thing, and it's going to be people deciding that they want to change their diets, but it's also going to be regulations that say, in order to take care of the environment, here's what we need to be doing. We can't have the entire state of Iowa planted in corn and soybeans. We have to have a more diversified agriculture. We have to make sure that we have biodiversity in there, and so on and so forth. It, as I said, it's not a simple question. If the question was, would grass-fed beef be a better thing, pasture-raised beef be a better thing, mm-hmm. the answer is yeah.
Yeah.
The short answer is yeah. From now on, I'm going to give one-word answers.
Okay. GMOs.
No problem. Two-word answer.
Yeah. Because you're recent, I guess September, early September, you wrote an op-ed story in the New York Times about the fact that advocates of the GMO law, you know, were sort of disappointed in what they ended up getting, but you felt that it was kind of the thin edge of the wedge, I think.
Well, I was being uncharacteristically optimistic. I'll rehash that argument. I'm in favor of 100% transparency. I want to see video cameras in places where they raise animals. I want to be able to go online and look at the meat I'm buying and see how that animal was raised. And technologically, this is a no-brainer. This is the simplest thing in the world. It's like buying a home security camera. Anyone can do it. So I want to know how workers are treated. I want to know how animals are treated. I want to know what kind of drugs are used in raising animals. I want to know what kind of pesticides are used in spraying crops. I want to know all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Pretty low on that list for me is whether the seed was genetically engineered or not. But okay, some people might think that's more important than others. No problem. I'd like to know that also. Why not? So to me, I said for years that the food movement putting its energy into an argument that GMOs needed to be labeled was a faulty priority. I thought, why are we not fighting for better pay for workers in the food industry? 8 of the 10 worst paying jobs in the United States are in the food industry, and we're worrying about how our seeds are created. I'd rather worry about how people are being treated, or how animals are being treated, or whether there's antibiotics being used in the food supply, which leads to the creation of superbugs, which means that antibiotics are less effective for those of us who get sick. When we get sick, we all do, and so on. Okay, that's my argument. The fact that the labeling law became a very, very mushy version of what GMO labeling advocates wanted, which is this contains GMOs on the front of the box or the can. And instead what we have now is a national labeling law that's going to say, here's a toll-free number, here's a website, scan this barcode, scan this QR code, and you'll get more information about this product. That did seem like a defeat compared to contains GMOs. But at the same time, all of those other things I'm concerned about, we can now say, okay, well, I'm scanning a barcode. You're giving me information about your product. I want more information about your product. I want to know if your workers have health insurance. I want to know what pesticides you're using, and so on down the line. As I said, the technology for even putting video cameras in places where animals are raised is a simple technology. The technology for putting information about a given product online, easiest thing in the world. So maybe that's a direction that'll work. Mm-hmm. I mean, the we all know from the internet that information is cheap, if not free, and abundant. So what you don't know about things is not because the information doesn't exist. It's because someone doesn't want you to have access to that information. Mm-hmm. So why not? Well, they have something to hide. What do they have to hide? That the way that they're producing this food in this instance would scare you to death if you were to know the details, or horrify you in some other way. So those are things we mm-hmm. want to know.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think I heard you talking about the bloody burger. These are, you know, a plant-based replacement for meat. And, you know, we've also seen, obviously, the vegan egg, vegan cheese. Do you see those as forward-thinking movements in the whole development of to shift to more of a plant-based diet, or are those temporary, more temporary distractions toward a...
That's a really good, that's a really good way of putting it. I think they are distractions. The Impossible Burger is amazing. I mean, it's you would be fooled. I mean, you can look at it and it looks suspicious. You can see this is not ground beef. But you have to look carefully. You have to wear your glasses, let's say. And when it's cooked, and especially if you put it on a bun with a tomato, in California style, as we sometimes call it back east, you put it on a bun with a tomato and mayonnaise and avocado and ketchup, you're never going to tell the difference. So the question becomes, what are the resources needed to make that burger versus what are the resources needed to make a real burger, a burger made from cow meat? And I don't have the answer to that question, but that's a question I'd like answered. Right now, if I thought we could decrease the number of beef animals being raised inhumanely by selling impossible meat, I'd be all for it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of dairy in this country. There is a lot of dairy in this country. And, you know, there's a story in the paper about farmers throwing away milk because prices are too low, and that, you know, that's a failed government policy, obviously. But the fact is that most of the cheese that we make is so bad that fake cheese is as good as it. But that doesn't mean that we can't be making good cheese, because people are making good cheese everywhere, and good cheese is a wonderful luxury, and that's a very, very high and smart use of milk. We're going to have dairy for a very long time in this country, maybe forever. So I think as long as we're raising dairy, we should be making cheese. If you're a vegan, obviously you want vegan cheese. If you're a non-vegan, I don't see any reason to be eating vegan cheese. If you know, it's there. I mean, it's not better. Yeah. It's better than Kraft's, or it's as good as Kraft singles, but that's a very low bar.
Then I wanted to talk a little bit about meal kits, just a little, because...
Actually, can I say one more thing on that subject?
Sure.
Because I wrote a story about this 5 years ago, let's say, 2012, I think. There was this guy doing fake chicken. There are many people doing fake chicken, but so there's this guy doing really good fake chicken. And it's you know, basically powder of legumes and what's that plant called? Lupines. And other things mixed together with water and maybe some other stuff and extruded into strips. And then you can grind it or you can fry the strips or whatever. And again, in a fast food usage or a very casual lunch kind of usage, sloppy Joe's or a taco or something with a lot of spice and some sauce and whatever, indistinguishable from bad chicken. I mean, 95% of the chicken in this country is bad chicken, right? Industrially raised chicken. So at that point, I feel like I encourage people to eat real food. I'm not interested in chicken substitute product. But if the chicken substitute product is virtually indistinguishable from the bad chicken, I'm at a loss. I can't say anything other than at least you're not killing a chicken to eat this, you know, kind of lousy tasting or neutral tasting fake chicken. Whereas if you eat the real chicken, it's still lousy tasting. So what's the point of killing the chicken for that?
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features food journalist and author Mark Bittman, whose most recent book is How to Bake Everything. He's joined in conversation by Margot True. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So we're going to all have to grapple with this stuff, and it's really quite complicated. Kids or younger people are going to have to grapple with it more because some of us are, you know, we're like old enough, we're just going to eat chicken, and we're not going to think about it that much. But, you know, if you're growing up with, you go to the case and there's chicken and there's Beyond Meat, which is what the best, I think the best chicken substitute is called, you're going to say, well, why kill the chicken? I'm just going to make this into a taco anyway. I'm not going to taste the difference. It's not like I'm going to be, it's not like I raised these birds or I know someone who raised these birds. Someone worked hard to raise them, make sure they ate well. They were out in the yard eating insects. They're scratching around. They had good lives. They gave me their good life for me to eat. It cost me $30 or whatever a good chicken actually costs. I'm going to enjoy it. But you're not going to turn that chicken into tacos. You're going to roast it and make yourself an awesome dinner. And that's, you know, that's meat eating in a way. This other stuff is like sloppy joes. I mean, what's that? It doesn't matter what's in there. You could have texturized vegetable protein. You won't know the difference.
Yeah. And then I wanted to ask you about smart kitchens a little bit, too.
I bet you know more about them than I do.
You know, where you're fridge will talk to your oven, and you can, you know, hook it up to your phone and tap in a recipe, and everything sort of goes from there. Your devices talk to one another to produce your food. Sam Cass, the former White House chef, is involved with one of these companies called Innit, and I wondered if you'd delved into that realm too. And if
it doesn't seem that I don't think I need my refrigerator to talk to my stove. I mean, I could make a phone call and get food delivered to me if I'm going to go that route. So I want to look. You go in the kitchen, you put some oil in a pan, you chop some garlic, you put that garlic in the oil. The smell, the sight, the sound of this, the sight. Next time you put garlic in oil and you get that bubbly thing, take out your phone and take a picture of that. That is as beautiful a sight as there is. The smell is incredible. The sight is incredible. The sounds are amazing. Your mouth starts watering. You put some chopped tomatoes in that, and that combination, as elemental as it is, why do you want to give that up? Why do you want to let someone else do it for you, make it easier? It wasn't very hard anyway. Rob yourself of that pleasure. I don't. So I don't think we have very many unscrewed up elemental pleasures left to us right now. I think we have exercise, which of course has become high tech in many ways, but many of us are old fashioned exercisers. We have sleep. We have sex. We have cooking. There's not a whole lot else. And we've lost cooking. You know, we've outsourced it, we failed to teach our children how to do it, but we're getting it back and we can get it back. I don't want to give that up. Thank you.
Hear, hear. All right. Well, you know, for everyone in the audience who cares about the issues that you're talking about. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about Plate of the Union and maybe also the National Food Policy Scorecard, because not everybody may know about those.
So I'm part of Union of Concerned Scientists, and we started a campaign with Food Policy Action called Plate of the Union. And the idea of Plate of the Union is to get candidates to talk about food. So we have successfully failed to get any presidential candidates to really talk about food. We haven't done a good job. I mean, we tried. It's not our fault. But we need to push candidates to talk about food on every level. So I think this needs to move forward way past the presidential election, and many people will be putting pressure on to deal with some food issues in a more aggressive and upfront way than President Obama did. But we need to talk to our local reps, our municipal officials, our state officials, our Congress people. You know, usually when you get to senators and presidents, we have no interaction with those people. But we can interact with our Congress people, and they're a big deal. And the questions, I would say, are, what do you think about antibiotics in the food supply? What do you think about marketing junk food to children? What do you think about the ethanol mandate? I mean, what do you think about minimum wage for food workers? Why are farm workers, especially in this state, why are farm workers being treated differently than other workers? That's a legacy of slavery. We don't need that stuff. Yeah. So these are issues that need to be raised on a national level. You know, you expect people in the Bay Area to be sympathetic to these issues. Great. It's why we love it here. But these are things that need to be discussed around the country, and these are things that need to be acted on. And, you know, without getting too heavy-handed, all of this relates to greenhouse gases and climate change. Agriculture done as it's being done now is either the second or third largest contributor to greenhouse gases of any sector. And these issues need to be addressed. So,
okay.
Yeah, that's that.
One last question. This is borrowing from the Tim Ferriss show. He often asks his guests, if there's one word you could put on a billboard, what would it be?
One word?
Okay, you could have two, because you could have more than two. What would you put on a billboard?
Well, if I had two, I'd say eat food.
Eat food. Okay. All right.
If I had three, I'd say eat real food.
Eat real food. Okay. All right. Thank you. Questions?
Margo started to ask a little bit ago about the food delivery services, the recipe delivery services.
Margo wanted to ask that too.
Right. So that's why I'm asking, because I'm interested in what you think about that, the price and the value and the portions.
Well, you know, I worked with one for a while. So, well, it's true. And I worked with Purple Carrot, which is the vegan meal delivery kit service. And I have to say that I haven't kept up with this since I left Purple Carrot, which was, say, 8 months ago. So I don't know what's going on. I believe that the prices are actually low. But I think the packaging is, let's say, a challenge. I was going to say a disgrace. But the packaging is a challenge. And in order to deal with the packaging, the price would need to go up. Shipping prices are not under control of the meal kit companies, so that's a problem too. Labor costs are aligned with labor costs in the rest of the food industry, which is to say that workers are paid badly. So if you do spend more money on packaging and shipping is fixed and you pay workers better and you source ingredients better, which from my limited knowledge, sourcing is not done that responsibly. If you do all those things, the cost is going to go up by 50% or more. Then they would be priced fairly, and then people could make a reasonable decision about the convenience of them and maybe feel better about them or maybe feel good about them. But it's in a way, it's like asking me what I think about supermarkets. You can buy really good food in most supermarkets, but the cost is often artificially low. The workers are being treated badly. We often don't know where the food comes from, or as I said before, there's not a lot of transparency in the food industry. As those things change, food will become more expensive. This is why, I'm going to save someone a question here, because I have done this before. This is why when you get to these kinds of questions, and it's a funny thing because it was an innocent enough question, but when you get to these kinds of questions about what food costs and valuing food at what it's actually worth or what the true costs are, and again, the true costs to the environment, the true costs to public health, the true costs to the workers who produce it, when you start factoring those in, food becomes more expensive. And I'm not talking about local or organic at this point. I'm talking about pricing food at its true cost. And then someone will inevitably say, in the old days, when people were less sophisticated 2 years ago, someone would say, someone would inevitably say, what about people who can't afford to shop at Whole Foods? And I would inevitably say, I never used the word Whole Foods in this conversation. You brought that up, not me. But the question, the legitimate question is, what about people who can't afford to buy real food? And my answer to that is, and this is why food is such an important issue, is that that's not a food issue. That is a social justice issue. So now we're talking about social justice. I'm happy to talk about social justice as long as you want, but what we're talking about now is income inequality. We're talking about discussion of guaranteed basic income. We're talking about how to make it so that the less well-off people in this country, and something like 50 million people in this country, are at least occasionally food insecure, can not only not be food insecure, because our definition of food insecure is they can't afford to buy Kraft dinner, as we call it in Canada. They can't afford to buy Kraft macaroni and cheese. That's kind of a definition of food insecure. If your definition of food insecure was people who can't afford to buy real good ingredients, it would be 100 million people probably. How do we fix that? It's not a food question. Just like how do we make sure that everybody has a decent place to live is not actually a housing question. It's a social justice question. So forgive me if you had no interest in hearing any of that. But
yes, could you share with us your thoughts about how we can eliminate food waste in this country?
Well, we're not going to eliminate it, but we obviously, I think you and others know how to reduce it in your personal lives. In public life, it's nice to read about restaurants giving away unused food to homeless shelters or whatever, or farmers markets that donate everything that's left at the end of the day to a soup kitchen. And these are smart and obvious things. But food waste starts in the fields, and in a way it starts with what we choose to plant. And, you know, the United States is a net importer of food. That is to say, we import more than we consume of our products, or that is, we don't grow enough to feed ourselves, and we don't grow enough. If everybody in the country were to eat five fruits and vegetables a day, there's no way we could produce that right now. We are wasting our best farmland on ethanol and on feed for animals and on grain for junk food. And I think that's where food waste starts. As for what's lost in transportation, what's lost in supermarkets, and so on, I think as food becomes more expensive, which is inevitable, people will be more careful with waste. Right now, it's so cheap, and the average American spends 7% of his or her income on food, which is by far the lowest in the world. It's so cheap that people can afford to waste it. When we price food according to its value, and when we price food according to what it costs to maintain the land, to maintain our health, to treat workers who raise food fairly, then food will become more expensive and we'll waste less of it. and we'll also plant more things that grow that we can eat, that is real food, as opposed to things that grow out of the ground that we use for non-food purposes.
Thank you for coming, first of all. And thank you also for teaching me how to cook, too.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for saying that.
I noticed you had a very long and very successful career, and I was wondering if you could go back and do something differently or change something that you've done. What would it be and why?
I can't. I'm sitting here. I'm really lucky. I'm quite happy. I have so much great work to do ahead of me. The projects I'm involved in now are so fantastic that even the mistakes, I mean, I could say, I wish I hadn't done this, I wish I hadn't done that, but even the mistakes are part of the fabric of where I am. So, you know, if I hadn't made this decision or that decision, which it, taken in a vacuum, I might regret, who knows what that mistake has led to. So, I'm not delusional. I'm not living in paradise. I have my issues, but I've worked hard to get to this place. I have many options. They're great options. I have, as I said, I have such great work to do. I want this. This is what I want. It's nice.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was food journalist and author Mark Bittman, whose most recent book is How to Bake Everything. He was joined in conversation by Margot True. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.